They'd definitely been fired by the same kind of gun. He switched samples. Closer. The third bullet was closer still. He carefully rotated the sample, comparing it with the round that was kept in the evidence case, and it... We got a match. He backed away from the scope, and another technician bent down to check. Yeah, that's a match. 100%, the man agreed. The boss ordered his men to check other rounds, and walked to the phone. Shaw, it's the same gun. 100% sure. I have a match on the round that killed the trooper. They're checking the ones from the Porsche now. Good work, Paul. You bet. I'll be back to you in a little while. Shaw replaced the phone and looked at his people. Gentlemen, we just had a break in the Ryan case. Chapter 22. Procedures. Robert Newton took the agents to the quarry that night. By dawn the next day, a full team of forensic experts was sifting through every speck of dirt at the site. A pair of divers went into the murky water, and 10 agents were posted in the woods to watch for company. Another team located and interviewed Newton's fellow woodcutters. Moore spoke with the residents of the farms near the road leading back into the woods. Dirt samples were taken to be matched with those vacuumed from the van. The tracks were photographed for later analysis. The ballistics people had already made further tests on the Uzi. The ejected cartridge cases were compared with those recovered from the van and the crime scene, and showed perfect matches in extractor marks and firing pin penetrations. The match of the gun with the crime and the van was now better than 100%. The serial number had been confirmed with the factory in Singapore, and records were being checked to determine where the gun had been shipped. The name of every arms dealer in the world was in the Bureau's computer. The whole purpose of the FBI's institutional expertise was to take a single piece of information and develop it into a complete criminal case. What it could not entirely prevent was having someone see them. Alex Dobbins drove past the quarry road on his way to work every day. He saw a pair of vehicles pulling out onto the highway from the dirt and gravel path. Though both the car and van from the FBI laboratory were unmarked, they had federal license plates, and that was all he needed to see. Dobbins was not an excitable man. His professional training permitted him to look at the world as a collection of small, discrete problems, each of which had a solution. And if you solved enough of the small ones, then the large ones would similarly be solved, one at a time. He was also a meticulous person. Everything he did was part of a larger plan, both part of and isolated from the next planned step. It was not something that his people had easily come to understand, but it was hard to argue with success, and everything Dobbins did was successful. This had earned him respect and obedience from people who had once been too passionate for what Alex deemed their mission in life. It was unusual, Dobbins thought, for two cars at once to come out of that road. It was out of the ordinary realm of probability that both should have government license plates. Therefore, he had to assume that somehow the feds had learned that he'd used the quarry for weapons training. How had it been blown, he wondered. A hunter, perhaps. One of the rustics who went in there after squirrels and birds. Or one of the people who chopped wood, maybe. Or some kid from a nearby farm. How big a problem was this? He'd taken his people to shoot there only 4 times, the most recent being when the Irish had come over. What does that tell me? He asked the road in front of his car. That was weeks ago. Each time they'd done all the shooting during rush hour, mostly in the morning. Even this far from D.C., there were a lot of cars and trucks on the road in the morning and late afternoon, enough to add quite a bit of noise to the environment. It was therefore unlikely that anyone had heard them. Okay. Every time they had shot there, Alex had been assiduous about picking up the brass, and he was certain that they'd left nothing behind, not even a cigarette butt, to prove that they'd been there. They could not avoid leaving tire marks, but one of the reasons he'd picked the place was that kids went back there to park on weekends. There were plenty of tire marks. They had dumped the gun there, he remembered, But who could have discovered that? The water in the quarry was over 80 feet deep. He'd checked, and looked about as uninviting as a rice paddy, murky from dirt that washed in, and whatever kind of scum it was that formed on the surface. Not a place to go swimming. They had dumped only the gun that had been fired. But as unlikely as it seemed, he had to assume they'd found it. How that had happened didn't matter for the moment. Well, we have to dispose of the others now, too, Alex told himself. You can always get new guns. What is the most the cops can learn? He asked himself. He was well-versed on police procedures. It seemed only reasonable that he should know his enemy, and Alex owned a number of texts on investigative techniques, the books used to train cops in their various academies, like Snyder's Homicide Investigation and the Law Enforcement Bible. He and his people studied them as carefully as the would-be cops with their shiny young faces. There could be no fingerprints on the gun. After being in water, the skin oil that makes the marks would long since have been gone. Alex had handled and cleaned it, but he didn't need to worry about that. The van was gone. It had been stolen to begin with, then customized by one of Alex's own people, and had used 4 different sets of tags. The tags were long gone, underneath a telephone power pole in Anne Arundel County. If something had resulted from that, he'd have known it long before now, Alex thought. The van itself had been fully sanitized. Everything had been wiped clean, the dirt from the quarry road. That was something to think about. But the van still led to a dead end. They'd left nothing in it to connect it with his group. Had any of his people talked? Perhaps a man with an aching conscience because of the kid who'd almost died? Again, had that happened, he would have awakened this afternoon to see a badge and gun in front of his face. So that was out. Probably. He'd talk to his people about that, remind them that they could never talk with anyone about what they did. Might his face have been seen? Alex chided himself again for having waved at the helicopter. But he'd been wearing a hat, sunglasses, and a beard, all of which were now gone, along with the jacket, jeans, and boots that he'd worn. He still had the work gloves, but they were so common an item that you could buy them in any hardware store. So dump 'em and buy another pair, asshole, he said to himself. Make sure they're the same color, and keep the sales receipt. His mind ran through the data again. He might even be overreacting, he thought. The feds could be investigating some totally unrelated thing. But it was stupid to take any unnecessary risks. Everything that they'd used at the quarry would be disposed of. He'd make a complete list of possible connections and eliminate every one of them. They'd never go back there again. Cops had their rules and procedures, and he'd unhesitatingly copied the principle to deny its advantage to his opponents. He had established the rules for himself after seeing what catastrophes resulted from having none. The radical groups he'd hovered around in his college days had died because of their arrogance and stupidity, their underestimation of the skill of their enemies. Fundamentally, they'd died because they were unworthy of success. Victory comes only to those prepared to make it, and take it, Alex thought. He was even able to keep from congratulating himself on spotting the feds. It was simple prudence, not genius. His route had been chosen with an eye to taking note of such things. He already had another promising site for weapons training. Eric Martins, Ryan breathed. We meet again. All of the FBI's data had been forwarded to the Central Intelligence Agency's working group within hours of its receipt. The Uzi that had been recovered, Ryan marveled at how that had happened, had, he saw, been fabricated in Singapore at a plant that also made a version of the M16 rifle that he'd carried in the Corps, and a number of other military arms, both east and west, for sale to third world countries, and other interested parties. From his work the previous summer, Ryan knew that there were quite a few such factories, and quite a few governments whose only measure for the legitimacy of an arms purchaser was his credit rating. Even those who paid lip service to such niceties as end-user certificates often turned a blind eye to the reputation of a dealer who never quite proved to be on the wrong side of the shadowy line that was supposed to distinguish the honest from the others. Since it was the dealer's government that generally made this determination, yet another variable was added to an already inexact equation. Such was the case with Mr. Martens. A very competent man in his business, a man with remarkable connections, Martens had once worked with the CIA-backed UNITA rebels in Angola until a more regular pipeline had been established. His principal asset, however, was his ability to obtain items for the South African government. His last major coup had been obtaining the manufacturing tools and dyes for the Milan anti-tank missile, a weapon that could not be legally shipped to the Afrikaner government due to the Western embargo. After 3 months' creative effort on his part, the government's own armaments factories would be making it themselves. His fee for that had doubtless been noteworthy, Ryan knew, though the CIA had been unable to ascertain just how noteworthy. The man owned his own business jet, a Grumman G3 with intercontinental range. To make sure that he could fly it anywhere he wished, Martens had obtained weapons for a number of black African nations, and even missiles for Argentina. He could go to any corner of the world and find a government that was in his debt. The man would have been a sensation on Wall Street or any other marketplace, Ryan smiled to himself. He could deal with anyone, could market weapons the way that people in Chicago traded wheat futures. The Uzis from Singapore had come to him. Everyone loved the Uzi. Even the Czechs had tried to copy it, but without great commercial success. The Israelis sold them by the thousands to military and security forces, always, most of the time, following the rules that the United States insisted upon. Quite a few had found their way to South Africa, Ryan read, until the embargo had made it rather more difficult. Is that the reason they finally let someone make the gun under license? Jack wondered. Let someone else broaden the market for you and just keep the profits. The shipment had been 5,000 units, about $2 million wholesale. Not very much, really. Enough to equip a city police force or a regiment of paratroopers, depending on the receiving government's orientation. Large enough to show a profit for Mr. Martens, small enough not to attract a great deal of attention. One truckload? Ryan wondered. Maybe two? The pallets of boxes would be tucked into a corner of his warehouse, technically supervised by his government, but more likely, in fact, to be Martin's private domain. That's what Sir Basil Charleston told me at the dinner, Ryan reminded himself. You didn't pay enough attention to that South African chap. So the Brits think he deals to terrorists? Directly? No, his government wouldn't tolerate that. Probably wouldn't, Ryan corrected himself. The guns might find their way to the African National Congress, which might not be very good news for the government they were pledged to destroy. So now Ryan had to find an intermediary. It took 30 minutes to get that file, involving a call to Marty Cantor. The file was a disaster. Martens had 8 known and 15 suspected intermediary agents, one or two in every country he sold to. Of course. Ryan punched Cantor's number again. I take it we've never talked to Martens? Ryan asked. Not for a few years. He ran some guns into Angola for us, but we didn't like the way he handled things. How so? The man's something of a crook, Cantor replied. That's not terribly unusual in the arms business, but we try to avoid the type. We set up our own pipeline after the Congress took away the restriction on those operations. I got 23 names here, Ryan said. Yeah, I'm familiar with the file. We thought he was passing arms to an Iranian-sponsored group last November, but it turned out he wasn't. It took us a couple of months to clear him. It would have been a whole lot easier if we'd been able to talk to him. What about the Brits? Jack asked. Stonewall, Marty said. Every time they try to talk with him, some big old Afrikaner soldier says no. You can't blame them, really. If the West treats them like pariahs, they're sure as hell going to act like pariahs. The other thing to remember is, pariahs stick together. So we don't know what we need to know about this guy, and we're not going to find out.
I didn't say that exactly.
Then we're sending people in to check a few things out? Ryan asked hopefully.
I didn't say that either.
Damn it, Marty!
Jack, you are not cleared to know anything about field operations. In case you haven't noticed, not one of the files you've seen tells you how the information gets in here.
Ryan had noticed that. Informants weren't named, meeting places weren't specified, and the methods used to pass the information were nowhere to be found. Okay. May I safely assume that we will, by some unknown means, get more data on this gentleman?
You may safely assume that the possibility is being considered.
He may be the best lead we have, Jack pointed out.
I know.
This can be pretty frustrating stuff, Marty, Ryan said, getting that off his chest.
Tell me about it. Cantor chuckled.
Wait till you get involved with something really important.
Sorry, but you know what I mean.
Like what the Politburo people really think about something, or how powerful and accurate their missiles are, or whether they have somebody planted in this building.
One problem at a time.
Yeah, that must be nice, sport, just to have one problem at a time.
When can I expect something on Martins? Ryan asked.
You'll know when it comes in, Cantor promised. Bye.
Great.
Jack spent the rest of the day and part of another looking through the list of people Martins had dealt with. It was a relief to have to go back to teaching class the next 2 days, but he did find one possible connection. The Mercury motors found on the Zodiac used by the ULA had probably, the bookkeeping had broken down in Europe, gone through a Maltese dealer with whom Martins had done a little business.
The good news of the spring was that Ernie was a quick study. The dog got the hang of relieving himself outside within the first 2 weeks, which relieved Jack of a message from his daughter, "Daddy, there's a little problem," invariably followed by a question from his wife.
"Having fun, Jack?"
In fact, even his wife admitted that the dog was working out nicely. Ernie could only be separated from their daughter with a hard tug on his leash. He now slept in her bed, except when he patrolled the house every few hours. It was somewhat unnerving at first to see the dog, rather to see a black mass darker than the night a few inches from one's face, when Ernie seemed to be reporting that everything was clear before he headed back to Sally's room for 2 more hours of protective slumber. He was still a puppy, with impossibly long legs and massive webbed feet, and he still liked to chew things. When that had included the leg of one of Sally's Barbie dolls, it resulted in a furious scolding from his owner that ended when he started licking Sally's face by way of contrition. Sally was finally back to normal. As the doctors had promised her parents, her legs were fully healed, and she was running around now as she had before. This day would mark her return to Giant Steps. Her way of knocking glasses off tables as she ran past them was the announcement that things were right again, and her parents were too pleased by this to bring themselves to scold the girl for her unladylike behavior. For her part, Sally endured an abnormally large number of spontaneous hugs, which she didn't really understand. She'd been sick, and she was now better. She'd never really known that an attack had happened. Jack was slow to realize. The handful of times she referred to it, it had always been the time the car broke. She still had to see the doctors every few weeks for tests. She both hated and dreaded these, but children adapt to a changing reality far more readily than their parents. One of these changes was her mother. The baby was really growing now. Kathy's petite frame seemed poorly suited to such abuse. After every morning shower, she looked at herself, naked, in a full-length mirror that hung on the back of the closet door, and came away with an expression that was both proud and mournful as her hands traced over the daily alterations.
"It's going to get worse," her husband told her as he emerged from the shower next.
"Thanks, Jack. I really need to hear that."
"Can you see your feet?" he asked with a grin.
"No, but I can feel them."
They were swelling, too, along with her ankles.
You look great to me, babe. Jack stood behind her, reaching his arms around to hold her bulging abdomen. He rested his cheek on the top of her head. Love you. That's easy for you to say. She was still looking in the mirror. Jack saw her face in the glass, a tiny smile on her lips. An invitation? He moved his hands upward to find out. Ouch! I'm sore. Sorry. He softened his grip to provide nothing more than support. Has something changed here? It took you this long to notice? The smile broadened a tad. It's a shame that I have to go through this for that to happen. Have you ever heard me complain? Everything about you has always been A+. I guess pregnancy drops you to a B-, but only in one subject, he added. You've been teaching too long, Professor. Her teeth were showing now. Kathy leaned back, rubbing her skin against her husband's hairy chest. For some reason, she loved to do that. You're beautiful, he said. You glow. Well, I have to glow my way to work. Jack didn't move his hands. I have to get dressed, Jack. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways, he murmured into her damp hair. 1, 2, 3. Not now, you lecher. Why? His hands moved very gently. Because I have to operate in 3 hours, and you have to go to Spook City. She didn't move, though. There weren't all that many moments that they could be alone. I'm not going there today. I got stuck with a seminar at the academy. I'm afraid the department is a little miffed with me. He kept looking in the mirror. Her eyes were closed now. Screw the department. God, I love you. Tonight, Jack. Promise? You've sold me on the idea, okay? She reached up to grab his hands, pulled them downward, and pressed them against the taut skin of her belly. He, the baby was definitely a he insofar as that was what they called him, was wide awake, rolling and kicking, pushing at the dark envelope that defined his world. Wow, his father observed. Kathy's hands were over his, moving them about every few seconds to follow the movements of the baby. What does that feel like? Her head leaned back a fraction. It feels good. Except when I'm trying to sleep, or when he kicks my bladder during a procedure. Was Sally this strong? I don't think so. She didn't say that it wasn't the sort of thing you remember in terms of strength. It was just the singular feeling that your baby is alive and healthy, something that no man would ever understand. Not even Jack. Kathy Ryan was a proud woman. She knew that she was one of the best eye surgeons around. She knew that she was attractive and worked hard to keep herself that way. Even now, misshapen by her pregnancy, she knew that she was carrying it well. She could tell that from her husband's biological reaction in the small of her back. But more than that, she knew that she was a woman, doing something that Jack could neither duplicate nor fully comprehend. Well, she told herself, Jack does things I don't much understand either. I have to get dressed. Okay. Jack kissed the base of her neck. He took his time. It would have to last until this evening. I'm up to 11, he said as he stepped back. She turned. 11 what? Counting the ways. Jack laughed. You turkey. She swung her bra at him. Only 11? It's early. My brain isn't fully functional yet. I can tell it doesn't have enough of a blood supply. The funny thing, she thought, was that Jack didn't think he was very good-looking. She liked the strong jaw, except when he forgot to shave it, and his kind, loving eyes. She looked at the scars on his shoulder and remembered her horror as she'd watched her husband run into harm's way, then her pride in him for what he had accomplished. Kathy knew that Sally had almost died as a direct result, but there was no way Jack could have foreseen it. It was her fault, too, she knew, and Kathy promised herself that Sally would never play with her seatbelt again. Each of them had paid a price for the turns their lives had taken. Sally was almost fully recovered from hers, as was she. Kathy knew it wasn't true of her husband, who'd been awake through it all while she slept. When that happened, at least I had the blessing of unconsciousness. Jack had to live through it. He's still paying that price for it, she thought. Working two jobs now, his face always locked into a frown of concentration, worrying over something he can't talk about. She didn't know exactly what he was doing, but she was certain that it was not yet done. The medical profession had unexpectedly given her a belief in fate. Some people simply had their time. If it was not yet that time, chance or a good surgeon would save the life in question. But if the time had come, all the skilled people in the world could not change it. Caroline Ryan, M.D., knew that this was a strange way for a physician to think, and she balanced the belief with the professional certainty that she was the instrument which would thwart the force that ruled the world. But she had also chosen a field in which life and death was rarely the issue. Only she knew that. A close friend had gone into pediatric oncology, the treatment of children stricken with cancer. It was a field that cried out for the best people in medicine, and she'd been tempted, but she knew that the effect on her humanity would be intolerable. How could she carry a child within her while she watched other children die? How could she create life while she was unable to prevent its loss? Her belief in fate could never have made that leap of imagination, and the fear of what it might have done to her psyche had turned her to a field that was demanding in a different way. It was one thing to put your life on the line, quite another to wager your soul. Jack, she knew, had the courage to face up to that. This, too, had its price. The anguish she occasionally saw in him could only be that kind of question. She was sure that his unspoken work at CIA was aimed at finding and killing the people who had attacked her. She felt it necessary. And she would shed no tears for those who had nearly killed her little girl. But it was a task which, as a physician, she could not herself contemplate. Clearly it wasn't easy for her man. Something had just happened a few days ago. He was struggling with whatever it was, unable to discuss it with anyone while he tried to retain the rest of his world in an undamaged state, trying to love his family while he labored to bring others to their death. It could not have come easily to him. Her husband was a genuinely good man, in so many ways the ideal man. At least for me, she thought. He'd fallen in love with her at their first meeting, and she could recount every step of their courtship. She remembered his clumsy, in retrospect, hilarious proposal of marriage, the terror in his eyes as she'd hesitated over the answer, as though he felt himself unworthy of her. The idiot. Most of all, she remembered the look on his face when Sally had been born. The man who had turned his back on the dog-eat-dog world of investments, the world that since the death of her mother had made her father into a driven, unhappy man, who had returned to teaching eager young minds, was now trapped in something he didn't like. But she knew that he was doing his best. And she knew just how good his best was. She'd just experienced that. Kathy wished that she could share it, as he occasionally had to share with her the depression following a failed procedure. As much as she had needed him a few painful weeks past, now he needed her. She couldn't do that. Or could she? What's been bothering you? Can I help? I can't really talk about it, Jack said as he knotted his tie. It was the right thing, but not something you can feel very good about. The people who... No, not them. If it was them... He turned to face his wife. If it was them, I'd be all smiles. There's been a break. The FBI... I shouldn't be telling you this, and it doesn't go any farther than this room. They found the gun. That might be important, but we don't know for sure yet. The other thing... Well, I can't talk about that at all. Sorry. I wish I could.
You haven't done anything wrong?
His face changed at that question. No. I've thought that one over the past few days. Remember the time you had to take that lady's eye out? It was necessary, but you still felt pretty bad about it.
Same thing.
He looked in the mirror. Sort of the same thing.
Jack, I love you, and I believe in you. I know that you'll do the right thing.
I'm glad, babe, because sometimes I'm not so sure. He held out his arms, and she came to him. At some French military base in Chad, another young woman was experiencing something other than a loving embrace, Ryan thought. Whose fault is that? One thing for sure, she isn't the same as my wife. She's not like this girl of mine. He felt her against himself, felt the baby move again, and finally he was sure. As his wife had to be protected, so did all the other wives, and all the children, and all the living people who were judged as mere abstractions by the ones who trained in those camps. Because they weren't abstractions, they were real. It was the terrorists who had cast themselves out of the civilized community and had to be hunted down one way or another. If we can do it by civilized rules, well and good. But if not, then we have to do the best we can, and rely on our consciences to keep us from going over the edge. He thought that he could trust his conscience. He was holding it in his arms. Jack kissed his wife gently on the cheek.
Thanks. That's 12.
The seminar led to the final 2 weeks of classes, which led in turn to final exams and commissioning week. Yet another class of midshipmen graduated to join the fleet and the Corps. The plebes were plebes no longer, and were finally able to smile in public once or twice per day. The campus became quiet, or nearly so, as the underclassmen went home for brief vacations before taking cruises with the fleet and preparing for plebe summer, the rough initiation for a new class of mids. Ryan was incongruously trapped in his real job for a week, finishing up a mountain of paperwork. Neither the Academy's History Department nor the CIA was very happy with him now. His attempt to serve two masters had not been a total success. Both jobs, he realized, had suffered somewhat, and he knew that he'd have to choose between them. It was a decision that he consciously tried to avoid, while the proof of its necessity piled up around him.
"Hey, Jack!" Robbie came in wearing his undress whites.
"Grab a seat, Commander. How's the flying business?"
"No complaints. The kid is back in the saddle," Jackson said, sitting down. "You should have been up in the Tomcat with me last week. Oh, man, I'm finally back in the groove. I was hassling with a guy in an A4 playing aggressor, and I ruined his day. It was so fine."
He grinned like a lion surveying a herd of crippled antelope.
"I'm ready."
"When do you leave?"
"I report for duty 5 August. I guess I'll be heading out of here on the 1st.
"Not before we have you and Sissy over for dinner."
Jack checked his calendar.
"The 30th is a Friday. 7 o'clock, okay?"
"Aye, aye, sir."
"What's Sissy going to do down there?"
"Well, they have a little symphony in Norfolk. She's going to be their number 2 piano soloist, plus doing her teaching on the side."
"You know they have the in vitro center down there. Maybe you guys can have a kid after all."
"Yeah, Kathy told her about that.
We're thinking about it, but...
Well, Sissy's had a lot of disappointments, you know."
"You want Kathy to talk to her about it some more?"
Robbie thought about that.
"Yeah, she knows how. How's she making out with this one?"
"She's bitching about her figure a lot."
Jack chuckled.
"Why is it that they never understand how pretty they look pregnant?"
"Yeah."
Robbie grinned his agreement. wondering if Sissy would ever look the same way to him. Jack felt guilty for touching a sensitive topic, and changed the subject.
By the way, what's with all the boats? I saw a bunch of yardbirds parked on the waterfront this morning.
That's moored, you dumb jarhead, Robbie corrected his friend. They're replacing the pilings over at the naval station across the river. It's supposed to take 2 months. Something went wrong with the old ones. The preservative didn't work or some such bullcrap. Your basic government contractor screw-up. No big deal. The job's supposed to be finished in time for the next school year. Not that I care one way or another, of course. By that time, boy, I'll be spending my mornings at 25,000 feet back where I belong. What are you going to be doing?
What do you mean?
Well, you're either going to be here or at Langley, right?
Ryan looked out the window.
Damned if I know.
Rob, we got a baby on the way and a bunch of other things to think about.
You haven't found him yet?
Jack shook his head.
We thought we had a break.
But it didn't work out.
These guys are pros, Robbie.
Jackson reacted with surprising passion.
Bullshit, man. Professionals don't hurt kids. Hey, they want to take a shot at a soldier or a cop, okay, I can understand that. It ain't right, but I can understand it, okay? Soldiers and cops have guns to shoot back with, and they got training. So it's an even match. Surprise on one side and procedure on the other, and that makes it a fair game. Going after non-combatants, they're just fucking street hoods, Jack. Maybe they're clever, but they sure as hell ain't professionals. Professionals got balls. Professionals put it on the line for real.
Jack shook his head. Robbie was wrong, but he knew of no way to persuade his friend otherwise. His code was that of the warrior, who had to live by civilized rules. Rule number 1 was, you don't deliberately harm the helpless. It was bad enough when that happened by accident. To do so on purpose was cowardly, beneath contempt. Those who did so merited only death. They were beyond the pale.
They're playing a goddamn game, Jack, the pilot went on. There's even a song about it. I heard it at Reardon's on St. Patrick's Day. I've learned all my heroes and wanted the same, to try out my hand at the Patriot game.
Something like that.
Jackson shook his head in disgust. War isn't a game. It's a profession. They play their little games and call themselves patriots and go out and kill little kids. Bastards.
Jack, out in the fleet, when I'm driving my Tomcat, we play our games with the Russians. Nobody gets killed, because both sides are professionals. I don't much like the Russians, but the boys that fly the bears know their stuff. We know our stuff, and both sides respect the other. There's rules, and both sides play by them. That's the way it's supposed to be.
The world isn't that simple, Robbie, Jack said quietly.
Well, it damn well ought to be.
Jack was surprised at how worked up his friend was about this.
You tell those guys at CIA. Find them for us, then get somebody to give the order, and I'll escort the strike in.
The last 2 times we did that, we lost people, Ryan pointed out.
We take our chances. That's what they pay us for, Jack.
Yeah. But before you toss the dice again, we want you over for dinner.
Jackson grinned sheepishly.
I won't bring my soapbox with me, I promise.
Dressy?
Robbie, am I ever dressy?
I told them it wasn't dressy, Jack said afterward.
Good, his wife agreed.
I thought you'd say that.
He looked up at his wife, her skin illuminated by moonlight.
You really are pretty.
You keep saying that.
Don't move. Just stay where you are.
He ran his hand across her flanks.
Why?
You said this is the last time for a while. I don't want it to be over yet.
The next time you can be on top, she promised.
It'll be worth waiting for.
but you won't be as beautiful as you are now.
I don't feel beautiful at the moment.
Kathy, you were talking to an expert, her husband pronounced. I am the one person in this house who can give out a dispassionate appraisal of the pulchritude of any female human being, living or dead, and I say that you are beautiful. End of discussion.
Kathy Ryan took her own appraisal. Her belly was disfigured by gross-looking stretch marks. Her breasts were bloated and sore, her feet and ankles swollen, and her legs were knotting up from her current position.
Jack, you are a dope.
She never listens, he told the ceiling.
It's just pheromones, she explained.
Pregnant women smell different, and it must tickle your fancy somehow or other.
Then how come you're beautiful when my nose is stuffy? Answer me that.
She reached down to twist her fingers in the hair on his chest. Jack started squirming. It tickled.
Love is blind.
When I kiss you, my eyes are always open.
I didn't know that.
I know. Jack laughed quietly. Your eyes are always closed. Maybe your love is blind, but mine isn't.
He ran his fingertips over her abdomen. It was still slick from the baby oil she used to moisturize her skin. Jack found this a little kinky. His fingertips traced circles on the taut, smooth surface.
You're a throwback. You're something out of a 30s movie.
She started squirming now.
Stop that.
Errol Flynn never did this in the movies, Jack noted,
without stopping that.
They had censors then.
Spoil sports. Some people are just no fun.
His hands expanded their horizons. The next target was the base of her neck. It was a long reach, but worth the effort. She was shivering now.
Now I, on the other hand...
I thought so.
Uh-oh. He's awake again.
Jack felt him almost as soon as his wife.
He, she, it was rotating. Jack wondered how a baby could do that without anything to latch on to. But the evidence was clear. His hands felt the lump shift position. The lump was his child's head, or the opposite end. Moving. Alive. Waiting to be born. He looked up to see his wife, smiling down at him, and knowing what he felt.
You're beautiful. And I love you very much. Whether you like it or not.
He was surprised to find that there were tears in his eyes. He was even more surprised by what happened next.
Love you too, Jack. Again?
Maybe that wasn't the last time for a while, after all.
Chapter 23 Movement
We got these last night. Priorities had changed somewhat at CIA. Ryan could tell. The man going over the photos with him was going gray, wore rimless glasses and a bow tie. Garters on his sleeves would not have seemed out of place. Marty stood in the corner and kept his mouth shut. We figure it's one of these three camps, right?
Yeah, the others are identified.
Ryan nodded. This drew a snort.
You say so, son.
Okay. These two are active. This one as of last week and this one 2 days ago.
What about 20, the Action Directe camp? Cantor asked.
Shut down ever since the Frenchies went in. I saw the tape of that. The man smiled in admiration. Anyway, here. It was one of the rare daylight photographs, even in color. The firing range adjacent to the camp had 6 men standing in line. The angle prevented them from seeing if the men held guns or not.
Weapons training? Ryan asked cautiously.
Either that or they're taking a leak by the numbers.
This was humor.
Wait a minute. You said these came in last night.
Look at the sun angle, the man said derisively.
Oh, early morning.
Around midnight our time.
Very good, the man observed.
Amateurs, he thought.
Everybody thinks he can read a recon photo. You can't see any guns, but see these little points of light here? That might be sunlight reflecting off ejected cartridge brass. Okay, we have 6 people here. Probably Northern Europeans, because they're so pale. See this one here with the sunburn? His arm looks a little pink. All appear to be male, from the short hair and style of dress. Okay, now the question is, who the hell are they?
They're not Axion Direct, Marty said.
How do you know that? Ryan asked.
The ones who got picked up are no longer with us. They were given trials by military tribunal and executed 2 weeks ago.
Jesus. Ryan turned away.
I didn't want to know that, Marty.
Those who asked had clergy in attendance.
I thought that was decent of our colleagues.
He paused for a moment, then went on. It turns out that French law allows for that sort of trial under very special circumstances. So despite what we both thought all the time, it was all done by the book. Feel better? Some, Ryan admitted on reflection.
It might not have made a great deal of difference to the terrorists, but at least the formality of law had been observed, and that was one of the things civilization meant.
Good.
A couple sang like canaries beforehand, too. DGSE was able to bag 2 more members outside of Paris. This hasn't made the papers yet, plus a barn full of guns and explosives. They may not be out of business, but they've been hurt.
All right, the man in the bow tie acknowledged. And this is the guy who tumbled to it?
All because he likes to see tits from 300 miles away, Cantor replied.
How come nobody else saw that first?
Ryan would have preferred that someone else had done all this.
Because there aren't enough people in my section. I just got authority to hire 10 new ones. I've already got them picked out. They're people who are leaving the Air Force. Pros.
Okay. What about the other camp?
Here. A new photo came into view. Pretty much the same thing. We have 2 people visible.
One's a girl, Ryan said at once.
One appears to have shoulder-length hair, the photo expert agreed. He went on. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a girl.
Jack thought about that, looking at the figure's stance and posture.
If we assume it's a girl, what does that tell us? He asked Marty.
You tell me.
We have no indication that the ULA has female members, but we know that the PIRA does. This is the camp. Remember that jeep that was driving from one to the other and was later seen parked at this camp?
Ryan paused before going on.
Oh, what the hell. He grabbed the photo of the 6 people on the gun range. This is the one.
And what the hell are you basing that on? The photo intel man asked.
Call it a strong hunch, Ryan replied.
That's fine. The next time I go to the track, I'll bring you along to pick my horses for me. Listen, the thing about these photos is what you see is all you got. If you read too much into these photos, you end up making mistakes. Big ones. What you have here is 6 people lined up, probably firing guns. That's all.
Anything else? Cantor asked.
We'll have a night pass at about 2200 local time. This afternoon, our time. I'll have the shots to you right after they come in.
Very good.
Thanks, Cantor said. The man left the room to go back to his beloved photo equipment.
I believe you call that sort of person an empiricist, Ryan observed after a moment.
Cantor chuckled.
Something like that. He's been in the business since we had U-2s flying over Russia. He's a real expert. The important thing about that is he doesn't say he's sure about something until he's really sure. What he said's true. You can easily read too much into these things.
Fine. But you agree with me.
Yeah.
Cantor sat on the desk next to Ryan and examined the photo through a magnifying glass. The 6 men lined up on the firing line were not totally clear. The hot air rising off the desert even in early morning was disturbed enough to ruin the clarity of the image.
It was like looking through the shimmering mirage on a flat highway. The satellite camera had a very high shutter speed. Actually, the photoreceptors were totally electronic. That canceled most of the distortion, but all they really had was a poorly focused, high-angle image that showed man shapes. You could tell what they were wearing, tan short-sleeved shirts and long pants, and the color of their hair with total certainty. A glimmer off one man's wrist seemed to indicate a watch or bracelet. The face of one man was darker than it should have been. His uncovered forearm was quite pale, and that probably indicated a short beard.
Miller has a beard now, Ryan reminded himself. Damn. If this was only a little better.
Yeah, Marty agreed. But what you see here is the result of 30 years of work, and God only knows how much money. In cold climates, it comes out a little better, but you can't ever recognize a face.
This is it, Marty. This is the one. We have to have something that confirms that, or at least confirms something.
Afraid not. Our French colleagues asked the people they captured. The answer they got was that the camps are totally isolated from one another. When the groups meet, it's almost always on neutral ground. They didn't even know for sure that there was a camp here.
That tells us something. The thing about the car?
It could have been somebody from the army, you know. The guy who oversees the guards, maybe. It didn't have to be one of the players who drove from this one to the provisionals camp. In fact, there is ample reason to believe that it wasn't. Compartmentalization is a logical security measure. It makes sense for the camps to be isolated from one another. These people know about the importance of security, and even if they didn't before, the French op was a gilt-edge reminder. Ryan hadn't thought about that. The raid on the Action Direct camp had to have an effect on the others, didn't it?
You mean we shot ourselves in the foot?
No. We sent a message that was worth sending. So far as we can determine, nobody knows what actually happened there. We have reason to believe that the suspicion on the ground is that a rival outfit settled the score. Not all of these groups like each other. So, if nothing else, we've fostered some suspicions among the groups themselves, and vis-à-vis their hosts. That sort of thing could break some information loose for us, but it'll take time to find out. Anyway, now that we know that this camp is likely to be the one we want, what are we going to do about it?
We're working on that. I can't say any more.
Okay. Ryan gestured to his desk. You want some coffee, Marty? Cantor's face took on a curious expression.
No, I'm off coffee for a while.
What Cantor didn't say was that a major operation had been laid on. It was fairly typical in that very few of the participants actually knew what was going on. A Navy carrier battle group centered on USS Saratoga was due to sail west out of the Mediterranean Sea and would pass north of the Gulf of Sidra in several days. As was routine, the formation was being trailed by a Soviet AGI, a fishing trawler that gathers electronic intelligence instead of mackerel, which would give information to the Libyans. When the carrier was directly north of Tripoli, in the middle of the night, a French-controlled agent would interrupt electrical power to some radar installations soon after the carrier started conducting nighttime flight operations. This was expected to get some people excited, although the carrier group commander had no idea that he was doing anything other than routine flight ops. It was hoped that the same team of French commandos that had raided Camp 20 would also be able to slip into Camp 18. Marty couldn't tell Ryan any of this, but it was a measure of how well Action Direct had been damaged that the French were willing to give the Americans such cooperation. While it hadn't exactly been the first example of international cooperation, it was one of three such operations that had actually been successful. The CIA had helped to avenge the murder of a friend of the French president. Whatever the differences between the two countries, debts of honor were still paid in full. It appealed to Cantor's sense of propriety, but was something known to only 20 people within the agency. The op was scheduled to run in 4 days. A senior case officer from the Operations Directorate was even now working with the French paratroopers who, he reported, were eager to demonstrate their prowess yet again. With luck, the terrorist group that had had the temerity to commit murder within the United States and the United Kingdom would be hurt by the troops of yet another nation. If successful, the precedent would signal a new and valuable development in the struggle against terrorism. Dennis Cooley was working on his ledger book. It was early. The shop wasn't open for business yet, and this was the time of day for him to set his accounts straight. It wasn't very hard. His shop didn't have all that many transactions. He hummed away to himself, not knowing what annoyance this habit caused for the man listening to the microphone planted behind one of his bookshelves. Abruptly, his humming stopped, and his head came up. What was wrong? The little man nearly leaped from his chair when he smelled the acrid smoke. He scanned the room for several seconds before looking up. The smoke was coming from the ceiling light fixture. He darted to the wall switch and slapped his hand on it. A blue flash erupted from the wall, giving him a powerful electric shock that numbed his arm to the elbow. He stared at his arm in surprise, flexing his fingers and looking at the smoke that seemed to be trailing off. He didn't wait to see it stop. Cooley had a fire extinguisher in the back room. He got it and came back, pulled the safety pin, and aimed the device at the switch. No smoke there anymore. Next, he stood on his chair to get close to the ceiling fixture, but already the smoke was nearly gone. The smell remained. Cooley stood on the chair for over a minute, his knees shaking as the chair moved slightly under him, holding the extinguisher and trying to decide what to do. Call the fire brigade? But there wasn't any fire. Was there? All his valuable books. He'd been trained in many things, but fighting fires was not one of them. He was breathing heavily now, nearly panicked until he finally decided that there wasn't anything to be panicked about. He turned to see three persons staring at him through the glass with curious expressions. He lowered the extinguisher with a shame-faced grin and gestured comically to the spectators. The light was off. The switch was off. The fire, if it had been a fire, was gone. He'd call the building's electrician. Cooley opened the door to explain what was wrong to his fellow shop owners. One remarked that the wiring in the arcade was horribly out of date. It was something Cooley hadn't ever thought about. Electricity was electricity. You flipped the switch and the light went on, and that was that. It annoyed him that something so reliable wasn't. A minute later, he called the building manager, who promised that an electrician would be there in half an hour. The man arrived 40 minutes later, apologizing for being held up in traffic. He stood for a moment, admiring the bookshelves.
"Smells like a wire burned out," he judged next. "You're lucky, sir. That frequently causes a fire."
"How difficult will it be to fix?"
"Oh, I expect that I'll have to replace the wiring. Ought to have been done years ago. This old place. Well, the electric service is older than I am, and that's too old by half."
He smiled. Cooley showed him to the fuse box in the back room, and the man went to work. Dennis was unwilling to use his table lamp, and sat in the semi-darkness while the tradesman went to work. The electrician flipped off the outside master switch and examined the fuse box. It still had the original inspection tag, and when he rubbed off the dust, he read off the date, 1919. The man shook his head in amazement.
Almost 70 bloody years.
He had to remove some items to get out the wall, and was surprised to see that there was some recent plasterwork. It was as good a place to start as any. He didn't want to damage the wall any more than he had to. With hammer and chisel, he broke into the new plaster, and there was the wire. But it wasn't the right one, he thought. It had plastic insulation, not the gutta-percha used in his grandfather's time. It wasn't in quite the right place, either. Strange, he thought. He pulled on the wire. It came out easily.
"Mr. Cooley, sir," he called.
The shop owner appeared a moment later.
"Do you know what this is?"
"Bloody hell,"
the detective said in the room upstairs. Bloody fucking hell! He turned to his companion, a look of utter shock on his face. Call Commander Owens!
I've never seen anything like this.
He cut off the end and handed it over. The electrician did not understand why Cooley was so pale. Neither had Cooley, but he knew what it was. The end of the wire showed nothing, just a place where the polyvinyl